Taking a sea journey along the Inside Passage from Washington to Alaska is a pretty common thing. Just Google Cruise Inside Passage and watch all the cruise line ads pop up. Our guest this hour made that journey, but no cushy cruise ship for her. Susan Marie Conrad made the trip through the Inside Passage between the islands and the mainland by sea kayak. She wrote a book about it called Inside, One Woman's Journey Through the Inside Passage. Susan has a lot of experience in paddling a sea kayak. In addition to her own adventures, Susan has worked as a kayak guide and instructor and a journalist, photographer, and graphic designer. She writes prolifically with work appearing in many magazines, newspapers, and journals. Inside is her debut in book form. Susan Marie Conrad, I understand a Southern Oregon University graduate. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's surreal to be back on this campus, I have to be honest.
A bit different over the years, I would think.
It's changed a bit. I haven't really explored. I literally just pulled in, parked, and walked down to Central Hall, my old stomping grounds.
Really? You spent a lot of time in this very building?
I did. Yes.
Well, so let's talk about the other places you spend time, because they tend to be a bit wetter than Central Hall. although it's interesting to think about your background, and there's not a lot of sea kayaking, for example, in upstate New York where you grew up. So where did you latch onto it?
Yeah, and actually when I left Ashland in 1991, I moved to landlocked Montana and lived there for 20 years. But, you know, I've always said you don't need the sea to sea kayak. Freshwater works just fine. So got my start on whitewater rivers. I'm actually here with the outdoor program on campus and really knew just enough to be dangerous. And then when I moved to Montana, I continued with my whitewater passion and also explored some of the big lakes and big, wide, lazy rivers and those longer, more lissome, stable sea kayaks. That's where I got my start.
So give me a sense of what it's like to sea kayak for the first time. I mean, kayaking in the pool at the university is one thing, and then you move on to flat water someplace else. But we're not talking flat water out in the ocean. The conditions are very different. What is it like to take a sea kayak out alone for the first time?
Well, I remember my very first experience in Montana. It was a calm lake, dead calm day, long, skinny sea kayak, and it felt very twitchy to me. I was kind of doing this jig, you know, in dead calm waters. And within about 5 minutes, I just started to breathe and loosen my death grip on the paddle and relaxed, you know, into it. And I knew almost immediately that this was for me. It was just a sport that I felt that I could really grow into. So to get to your question about what's it feel like to set off alone on an expedition of this sort, mm-hmm. it's... Well, at the time, you know, I was incorrigibly prepared for this journey. I had prepared for the better part of 9 months. So I was feeling pretty empowered, and it was almost surreal that it's like, wow, this is actually happening. I'm taking my first strokes, and I'm paddling myself to Alaska.
This is a long trip. Was it 1,200 miles?
1,148, to be exact, according to my GPS.
We'll call it 1,200.
Yeah, round it up.
Okay, you probably took a few jogs here and there. So from Anacortes, Washington to Juneau, Alaska, given your love for the region, though, and you clearly do express that in the book, I'm surprised it took you so many years to get around to doing this. I mean, what stars finally lined up to make this happen?
Yeah, timing is everything, right? I was involved in the paddle sports industry for nearly 20 years in Montana. And so I was always busy, always working, long, arduous days in the summertime. And then finally, things changed in my life, and I let go of certain things to open doors for new things. And for the first time in my life, I had two things that wasn't common, time and money. And so I was also at a point in my life where things had kind of spun off kilter. It's like, you know, when it rains, it pours sort of thing. My father had recently passed away. A long-term relationship had dissolved. My dog died, you know. All these crazy things, and I was making some really poor choices. And I've always been this person that's had this insatiable curiosity to have to know what's around the next corner. And I think I was just at a point in my life where I desperately needed a next corner. And the Inside Passage became that next corner, my new goal.
Definitely had to have time and money. And we didn't mention the time part of this, not quite 1,200 miles, as you pointed out, but 66 days, which is a long time to be gone from anything.
66 days on the water. The journey itself from door to door was 75, with getting myself to the coast, the last minute logistic preparations, the paddle itself, and then the ferry ride back. and then the drive back. So a 75-day adventure.
Wow, that's a long time. So the Inside Passage, I should point out, every time we say IP, we're not going to be talking about Internet Protocol. It is IP is the abbreviation for Inside Passage. And there's a name in here that we need to get to, which is Jim Chester.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about how he figured in your IP story getting started in the first place.
Yeah, Jim's a dear friend of mine. He had paddled the Inside Passage also solo in 1992. And he was just a big inspiration for me to want to do the same. And so he became my mentor of sorts and was my logistics person. Since he had done the trip himself, he knew how critical it was to get those resupply boxes mailed out at specific times so that they arrived at these post offices and these ports of call that I would paddle into. I always refer to him as my forward bearing and my back azimuth. He was just my remote cheering squad, and he was invaluable component to the journey. And you've read the book, you've heard his voice sprinkled throughout the narrative, so you've probably come to understand what a critical role he played in this journey and my life as well.
He was emailing people on your behalf as you went through the IP.
Yes, I had quite the following. I had several hundred of my friends and family. We had this group email set up, and I also used a spot satellite tracking device where people could log on to Google Earth and literally track me. It was sort of like a "Where in the ocean is Susan now?" button.
Uh-huh.
And so Jim monitored that, day and night, and he always knew where I was at and could plan accordingly for me from a remote distance.
So we're talking about a long and arduous journey that even if you had the time and the money, there's still the issue of shoulder muscles and things like that. We'll talk about all that with Susan Marie Conrad. She wrote the book Inside, One Woman's Journey Through the Inside Passage. On the way to the break, let me remind you, it's the final day of our Spring Fund Drive here at Jefferson Public Radio, seeking your pledge of support at ijpr.org and 888-552-6191. Back with Susan Marie Conrad and Inside in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Susan Marie Conrad, who has a lot of experience in paddling sea kayaks. She has not only done a lot of it herself, but also instructs other people in the good and proper use of sea kayaks. And she took the plunge in a big way and traveled the Inside Passage from Anacortes, Washington to Juneau, Alaska, solo in an 18-foot sea kayak, 1,200 miles. Okay, not quite 1,200 miles. We'll cut it back a little bit. But 66 days on the water. She describes it all in the book Inside, One Woman's Journey Through the Inside Passage. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the actual narrative begins at something of a low point with you shouting obscenities in the Grenville Channel. What happened?
Yes. Oh, boy. You got to bring people right into the action there.
Did that.
The misery, my nemesis, Grenville Channel. I almost threw in the towel right there. I literally had my finger on my VHF radio, which was how I could call for help. And I was rehearsing what I was going to say when whatever ship picked up that transmission and was going to rescue me. So Grenville Channel is a long glacial carved fjord, nearly 100 miles in length, almost stick straight, about 2,000 foot sheer vertical cliffs that plunge into the sea.
So no place to land.
Landing spots were few and far between. And I would be lucky to land, let alone a place to set up camp. And 9 times out of 10, there would be mama grizzly bears with cubs on these tiny little pocket beaches that I hope to, get out and take a break. In addition to that, it's an area that's prone to extreme tidal differences. I'm talking minus tides to like 24, 25 foot high tides.
Wow.
And timing is everything, right? When I was going through this area, I was approaching the summer solstice and a new moon. So those factors exaggerate those extreme tidal differences. So now everything is even more pronounced and more dramatic. Also, the weather is deteriorating. Gale force winds are starting to go up this channel, and there is no place to get out. So, long story short, that particular day that I was having a major hissy fit, was not a happy camper. I had paddled myself an unintentional 40 miles.
Ouch.
I was pretty much averaging the distance of a marathon every day, which was doable at that time. I was in pretty good shape. But
26 miles. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 26 miles. 40 miles was over the top, and they weren't an easy 40 miles. So I was hypothermic, mildly hypothermic, and I was aware of that. I was almost to the point of hallucinating because I was just so exhausted, and there was no place to get out of the boat. And then I kept seeing grizzly bears with cubs, literally in tears as I'm paddling, like, whose idea was this? So I finally find a really marginal campsite. I had to make it work. And I'm slipping and falling and having the classic hypothermia symptoms, the stumbles, umbles, mumbles, and fumbles, as I recall when I used to teach hypothermia back here on campus with the outdoor program. And I knew this was getting pretty serious, and the wind was picking up, and I'm struggling with my nylon tarp, and the wind is just belligerently whipping it out of my hands time and time again. And I knew this was getting pretty serious. And what really saved me was my rage. Just, I started screaming, like, this profanities that I didn't even know I was capable of, just screaming at the top of my lungs. And I think that it was like a life-giving rage, and it pressed that mental reset button in my brain. And all of a sudden, I just remember it clicking, and everything just stopped and slowed down. And I just thought, okay, you've got yourself in this situation. You better figure a way out. And so I did. I just started moving slower and more deliberately. And it's like, okay, get the damn tarp up, get the tent up, get into dry clothes, get some food in your belly, get in the tent, and you will wake up alive the next day. And obviously, that's what happened.
What did your shoulders feel like on the morning after going 40 miles in into the wind?
Yeah, it's it's not just your shoulders. Kayaking, especially if it's done properly, is really a whole body workout. And you know, my boat, not counting my body weight, was close to 200 pounds with all the gear, food, and water. Were very heavy, and the boat itself, totally empty, was close to 60 pounds. So I'm pushing about 150 to 200 pounds of boat and gear plus my body weight. So it's very much an all body activity. I use my legs a lot, you know, more powerful muscles in my thighs and my core as well. So my whole body actually just ached, in addition to my, you know, my biceps and my shoulder muscles.
Were there days then when you just said, you know, I'm just going to sit this one out. I'm going to just sit here and enjoy the view and take a day off?
Rarely. And if I ever had this to do over again, that would be the one thing I would do differently. I've always struggled with, you know, sort of being in the moment and soaking up the experience and just sitting there and enjoying my surroundings and the sunset and the whales breaching out in front of me. But I've always been this, well, kind of a type A personality, and it was just always go, go, go. There were very few times where I stayed in camp just to enjoy that experience. Mother Nature dictated when I would stay. There were times when, one particular place, very aptly named Cape Caution, I was promptly storm-bound there for 3 days with 30-foot seas raging out around that cape.
Yeah,
I wasn't going anywhere. So it was a great place to be storm-bound. I did enjoy that experience, a two-mile-long sandy beach. Just blow your socks off.
Wow, that's amazing. Susan Marie Conrad is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She paddled the Inside Passage from Anacortes to Juneau, not quite 1,200 miles, and tells the story in her book, Inside, One Woman's Journey Through the Inside Passage. So the basic rundown, I mean, how much? You mentioned 150 pounds of gear. So how do you stay warm? How do you stay dry? What do you do when you run low on anything? Where's the nearest bathroom? I mean, the basic creature comfort story here.
Yeah, and that, you know, that was really a big draw for me. What I enjoyed a lot about this trip was everything was, you know, pared down to the basics. Life was very simple in that sense. I pretty much lived in a wetsuit for the entire time, and of course fleece layers under that and a dry top. So as long as I was moving, for the most part, I was fine. I was warm, and I wouldn't say dry, but I was warm and clammy and damp most of the time, but happy. And then when I would get into camp, you know, I had some precious clothes in a dry bag, a few pieces of fleece that I wore over and over and over for 66 days. And then what I wore in the tent was strictly only for the tent, that, you know, that could not get wet. That
like
was sort
an
of
airlock. This is the
that was my lifeline. Yeah. Yeah. And then as far as food, I never ran out of food or really even came close to running out of food. I the logistics part of this trip, I prepared for the better part of 9 months on many levels, logistically, physically, even.
You freeze-dried a lot of food yourself?
Well, dehydrated. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a big fan of dehydrating. So I had almost every single meal pre-planned. I ate fairly well mm-hmm. on this expedition.
What kinds of things did you stock away?
I dehydrated lots of fruits and vegetables, lots of like different sauces and... I even dehydrated brownies. I'm a bit of a chocoholic, uh-huh. if you can believe that. And a lot of one-pot meals, pretty much anything that you can make at home, you can dehydrate and just add boiling water and camp. One of my favorites was chili. You know, just whip up these huge batches of your favorite chili recipe and then lay it out in your dehydrator trays and dry it and get into camp and add boiling water. And it's absolutely delicious. And the nutritional value is the same. The only thing that might be a little different would be the texture with certain recipes.
Oh, I can imagine that. Sure. Yeah. So you do offer some backstory about your formative years and your development into what you describe as a guarded, if not stoic, young adult. And frankly, what a horror show.
Yeah.
Did getting on the water give you great release from the things you'd experienced as a child?
Very much so. You know, we all have our passions and our happy place, and being on the water has always been that happy place for me. Just a place where I could just kind of let go and press that reset button. It's always been a place of healing and introspection for me. Yeah, and reminds me that, you know, I get to choose. You can either, you know, seize the day or become a victim of the day. And just being on the water reminds me of that in a really special way.
You went through the foster child system, and so there were multiple parents involved in your life at different times, and lots of other incidents that you describe in greater detail in the book. I just mm-hmm. want to make sure that people are aware. When I say what a horror show, that's the basic outline of it all.
Yeah.
This trip, though, I mean, what was the longest trip you had taken before that point?
Let's see. I think once I decided I was going to paddle the Inside Passage, you know, it occurred to me that I'd never done anything substantial alone on saltwater. I'd done a lot of solo trips in Montana, backpacking and a couple of long weekends. So I decided on a 10-day training trip on the west side of Vancouver Island. And that was sort of a shakedown trip to see if I could cut the mustard for a longer trip. So that was the longest that I'd done up until this point. And I realized on that 10-day training trip that, you know, I definitely felt like I had the skills and I had the gear and the camping savvy and all that. But what I was really out there for was to address my fears. And that was my, you know, my constant struggle. Those not just the outward challenges, like the obvious outer challenges, but also those inner challenges that entailed, you know, my fears as a woman traveling solo on the ocean.
Which Susan Marie Conrad did indeed do, all the way from Anacortes to Juneau, a distance of not quite 1,200 miles, 66 days. Her book is called Inside, One Woman's Journey Through the Inside Passage. And she has a couple of appearances coming up in the Rogue Valley. The Northwest Outdoor Store tonight at 6. That's in Medford on Biddle Road. April 13th, that's tomorrow at the REI in Medford at 6:30 in the evening. And then next Tuesday, April 18th at 7 p.m. at Bloomsbury Books in downtown Ashland for some reading and some FaceTime with folks in the audience. You can meet Susan Marie on the phone or by email right here on the Jefferson Exchange now at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned 30-foot swells on the day you didn't go out there.
Yes.
But how big were some of the swells on the days when you did venture out?
I think my biggest conditions were... it's really hard to judge wave height from the vantage point of a kayak. When you're sitting that low in the water, they're just towering over you. People tend to overestimate. But I would guess 8 to 10 foot waves, and just mostly big swell. You know, if those were breaking, I would have been in serious trouble, of course. All the big crossings, my crossing of the Strait of Georgia, crossing from Vancouver Island over to the mainland, and then Queen Charlotte Strait, which is a serious body of water. That was an 18-mile open ocean crossing, and that was some of the biggest water that I believe I've ever been in.
I love some of the fond names you get, though, for these places, though. Like, you know, the Georgia Strait becomes Miss Georgia.
Miss Georgia. Yeah, she was quite moody.
But you mentioned trying to get some timing in here. So, I mean, it was a set of days you chose, but within that day, were you also picking and choosing the times when you would make your move to try to stay with the tidal movements and things like that?
In specific areas, it depended on where I was geographically and what was going on with those tides and currents. Since I was averaging, 25 to 30 miles a day, and the tide changes every 6 hours in most places, you couldn't always go with the flow. There were times when I had to buck the current. But when it was really critical and I really needed to pay attention to my GPS, and the tide and current tables were some of those pinch points where the water would constrict between land masses. And there was no way that I was going to paddle against that current, or I would be, in serious trouble. Or I wanted to make sure if I was going with the flow, that I wanted to go through before it turned into this raging saltwater river. So there were about, maybe 5 or 6 points throughout the entire expedition where I really needed to be keen on what that timing was and be, spot on with my calculations. It was kind of nerve-wracking for me, but I was somewhat successful in all of my plotting and planning. I'm here.
You're sitting here talking about
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So what, Susan, was the first thing you wished you had brought with you that you hadn't?
The first thing that I wished I had brought with me. Oh, yes. That would bring me back to Grenville Channel, the southern reaches of that particular area. I was literally eaten alive by black flies my first night, to the point of being, my face was disfigured. It was so swollen and disfigured. My eyes were shut to almost like little slits. And as soon as I got to a point where I could communicate with the outside world, I touched base with Jim, my resupply guy, and I said, put a mosquito jacket, netting, in that next resupply box, and which he immediately did. Of course, that took a while for that to get to me. And of course, once I had that packed in the kayak, I didn't need it again, Murphy's Law. Mm-hmm. But that was pretty much the only thing. I had spent a lot of time going through every single piece of equipment and what I was going to need and what was extraneous, and pretty much had that all dialed in. It worked out really well.
Grab the headphones. We have a phone call for you. Let's go and talk to Connie in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Susan Marie Conrad, the author of Inside.
Good morning.
Hi.
Fascinating topic. I have done, when I was younger, I did a lot of hiking alone, and campsite choice was really premier. And I wondered, in the unique, very unique to me, I've never sea kayaked, challenges of finding a campsite, one, when you're up against cliffs and tide changes, and then two, you've got a lot of animals, not just the bears, but other animals to interact with.
Mm-hmm.
The third one is humans.
Yes.
And so I just would like to hear how you made those choices, some I'm sure by necessity, but others by choosing.
Yeah.
Right. Thanks, Connie.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. Many of the campsites I had plotted out ahead of time, pouring over my charts at home in the comfort of my little cabin back in Montana, and based on Jim's expedition, I knew where some of those nicer campsites were. But of course, Mother Nature is going to dictate a lot of that. And either there would be, crashing surf, I wouldn't be able to land there because it would be too dangerous, or the tides might be too high and it'd be obvious that there is no way that my tent is going to survive this particular patch of sand. So I would, keep going and going and going. And, my biggest fear, you mentioned humans. I think one of my biggest fears was that of men with ill intentions, coming into a campsite, particularly when I was closer to these ports of call, civilization, where there was signs of human, like, wads of toilet paper or old blue tarps wadded up in a tree root or something like that. And that always gave me great pause. Fortunately, I would go with my gut instinct on that and just, you know, usually I would move on if it didn't feel right about camping in a particular location.
Did you consider taking a companion with you at any point? Did you ask anybody, or was this always meant to be a solo trip?
It was meant to be solo. I chose to go solo for a variety of reasons, and mostly because I knew that there would be some valuable lessons learned on this trip, and I feel that those lessons and the ability to ponder deeper truths, if you will, are best acquired in solitude. But I actually did have a friend accompany me on one leg of the trip, and it was about halfway through the journey. My dear friend Becky Hardy, I referred to her as Chapter 5 Becky, mm-hmm. and it was sort of like an intermission. It was a really great point to have someone accompany me for about 120 miles, and it was also had the potential of being the most dangerous part of the trip because of its sheer exposure. So it was really nice to have someone accompany me for those miles.
We're talking to Susan Marie Conrad about her trip through the Inside Passage in an 18-foot sea kayak, most of the time completely alone. Her book is called Inside. We'll come back and talk more with Susan on the Jefferson Exchange in just a bit. On the way to the break, let me remind you, it is the final day of spring fun to drive here on Jefferson Public Radio. The numbers are looking good at an important time for public media in America, given the preference by the administration to not have any public money go to public media. So it really falls back on the people who listen and consume public media to support it. And we hope you'll do that with a pledge at ijpr.org online. You can use the smartphone app for JPR if you have that to make the pledge, or you can use the phone and call us at 888-552-6191. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Susan Marie Conrad, an experienced sea kayaker and instructor, about her experience kayaking the Inside Passage all the way from Anacortes, Washington to Juneau, Alaska. They're not neighboring states. There's a lot of British Columbia in between them and nearly 1,200 miles of ocean, some of it, in fact, quite open, as we heard a moment ago. It took her 66 days. She writes it up in the book Inside, A Woman's Journey, One Woman's Journey Through the Inside Passage. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So I've tended to focus on the physical stuff so far, and because mm-hmm. this is a not a safe kind of thing to do. You know, you don't just hop in a motorboat up the Inside Passage. You have to take care of it yourself, and you have to be aware of lots of other forces of nature around you. But mm-hmm. but even before you took off, Susan, was there a concern about the amount of solitude you'd have? I mean, that you'd just be alone with your thoughts for mm-hmm. what turned out to be more than 2 months?
Well, no, not really, because solitude was really at the heart of my journey. That was one of the reasons I intentionally set off solo. You know, I had been leading fairly large groups of people. I owned my own kayak company and would bring folks on guided trips and was always conducting lessons and that sort of thing. So I was very much ready for some alone time, especially on the water. And I'm one of those people that doesn't necessarily equate solitude with seclusion or isolation. For me, it's more of introspection, a time for introspection and self-harmony. And that's really how it ended up being. I had, you know, all those miles, 1,148 miles, there was a lot of time for going deep into my thoughts and quite a bit of soul searching, which was really lovely. It's what I signed up for.
Sort of navigating your own inside passage.
Absolutely, yes.
So how different a person would you say you were at the end of that 66-day trip from the person who existed at the beginning?
Quite different. I didn't realize it, you know, at the time. I was just pretty much ecstatic when my bow scrubbed up on that shoreline in Juneau. I was, you know, it was a milestone moment. I was very proud and ecstatic, but it would take quite some time. And still to this day, you know, I'm coming up on the 7-year anniversary of my launch date, that I'm realizing how profound and life-changing this journey was. And it's really, and a lot of this came out in the process of writing the book, because the process of writing started to teach me what I really needed to write about. And I realized how this journey sort of became a paradigm of my life's journey. And it's a benchmark that I'll continually draw from. And when I returned from this trip, you know, my life wasn't just Cherry and Rosie, there was still the what I referred to as the tumultuous seas of everyday life, and I started to do that knee-jerk reaction thing where I would go back to my self-defeating behaviors, and then I had to remind myself. It's like, Susan, you know, if you could paddle 1,200 miles solo and deal with all these challenges and obstacles that are placed in your path, you can certainly deal with, you know, whatever it is that I'm dealing with, the day-to-day adventures of life.
You have to allow yourself to occasionally be impressed by yourself.
Yeah, I guess you could put it that way. Yeah, yeah. Just know that I, one of the biggest things I got out of this journey was that I can be very determined and resolute, if not downright stubborn. And also that I can be very patient. Patience is a muscle that I'm always trying to strengthen and tone. And I learned that the sea will teach you patience. Absolutely.
There were times you had to go ashore to resupply. And how often was that? I mean, how often would you go without seeing people until you had to stop at least for a post office run to pick up your stuff?
Yeah, I had six resupply ports of call, towns that I would paddle into to retrieve these supplies that were typically mailed to post offices. And I think my longest stretch was close to 2 weeks in between these resupply towns.
I love the detail of coming ashore in Nanaimo and buying yourself a shower.
Oh, yeah.
Like heaven.
Yeah, I was kind of complaining at how much it cost, but once that hot water hit my body, it was like, oh, yeah, it's worth every penny.
So, I mean, did you get pruny at all? I mean, from wearing the wetsuit all the time and being damp constantly?
Oh, yeah, yeah. My especially my hands, you know, hikers, their nemesis are their feet, their heels. They can end up looking like hamburger after long hikes. And that's what my hands look like. In very dire need of a manicure. They were just hideous, bloody, swollen. And, you know, they just progressively got worse and worse. You think they would toughen up, but they didn't. They just, because they were always wet and pruny, they were very, very painful at times. And the wetsuit, yeah, your body eventually adapts, but It was not a pleasant experience living in that wetsuit day after day and putting that thing on. It's kind of like putting on wet underwear every morning, just way, way worse.
When you were describing it in the book, I was thinking of those times as a kid when you live for the whole summer in a bathing suit,
yeah,
and you put it back on the next morning.
What we do for fun.
Right. So you did, on these resupply missions and to stop for a shower in Nanaimo and things like that, you did come in contact with people. And
yeah,
what was often the response when you told them, like, oh, I'm doing this thing, and you gave the tale or two?
It was kind of a mix. Some people were absolutely blown away, and they're like, you started where? You know, I'd be like way up in the northern reaches of Alaska, and it was almost unbelievable to them. And they thought I was crazy, of course, particularly a woman out there doing this solo. I had a lot of, especially women that I would encounter on, you know, big yachts and sailboats that really had this mothering instinct and wanted to take me under their wing and ply me with, you know, food and drink, which is great, you know, go for it. And then there were particularly the fishermen, I remember, that had, you know, make their living off of the sea. And I really sensed a respect in them. They knew, they could see that I was, this wasn't like this foolhardy adventure, that I had really planned this out. And I more or less knew what I was doing. And they just, they knew what I was up against. And they really respected what I had set out to do and accomplish.
Is it funny to you or annoying or something that we're still having the discussion about women traveling alone on long journeys? I mean, it is the 21st century. The feminine mystique was 60 years ago now,
mm-hmm,
and yet we're still having these, like, oh, it's a woman traveling alone discussions.
Yeah, it is annoying to me, actually. I think, you know, it's empowering for me, and I think, you know, like I mentioned before, everybody has their happy place, and particularly for women, you know, whatever it is that that makes you feel, you know, I think we all strive to be stronger, better versions of ourselves. And that was the big draw for me. I wanted to see how I would handle adversity. So, you know, my take on that is to just, you know, get outside and, you know, find your own inside, you know, whatever floats your boat sort of thing.
So it doesn't have to be 1,150 miles on the Inside Passage but something that makes you feel like you're a person with some strength.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Is this, so would you recommend this particular kind of trip to anyone again, or would you offer some revisions from your own plan to what they might do?
That's a great question. I think the book is, you know, it's a book for the adventurer in all of us. And, you know, my takeaway message is really to that we're all infinitely more capable of accomplishing anything that we want in life. We just have to, you know, understand that we have it. It's inside of us all along. We really just have to believe and you know, we have to act on that passion and just get out there and go for it in a responsible sort of manner.
Inspirational and damp at the same time.
Yes.
The book is called Inside, One Woman's Journey Through the Inside Passage. Susan Marie Conrad wrote it. She'll be at the Northwest Outdoor Store on Biddle Road in Medford tonight at 6 p.m. Mm-hmm. She'll be at the REI in Medford tomorrow night at 6:30, and then next Tuesday, April 18th, at 7 p.m. at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland. Susan Marie Conrad, thanks so much for sharing the details of your journey with us, both in the book and in the studio.
Thank you for having me in the studio. This has been fantastic.
Good to have you here in the Jefferson Exchange.